Welcome to Profiles. I'm David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be talking with record label owner and cultural entrepreneur Chris Swanson. Chris Swanson grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and moved to Bloomington in 1994, where he graduated with a BA in Religious Studies from Indiana University. He's one of the founders of the Bloomington-based, critically lauded independent recording companies Secretly Canadian and Jagjaguar, artist-friendly labels known for coupling a fertile artistic environment with ambitious business plans. Swanson works in developing over 30 musical artists, some of which have gone on to international acclaim, such as Anthony and the Johnsons, Black Mountain, Magnolia Electric Company, and Okkervil River. In addition to artist development, he co-runs SC Distribution, which exclusively distributes 18 record labels globally, as well as Bellwether Manufacturing, a media replication company which works with over 200 record labels, and he also runs Plan 9, a video store in downtown Bloomington, and he's also a passionate lover of music. Chris, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks.
So what were you listening to when you drove over here for the interview, just out of curiosity?
I was listening to WIUX.
WIUX, yeah. The new college radio station here in Indiana. It's actually the old WIUS, now WIUX.
Used to be IUS when I was there, and it's now exciting. It's exciting that they've gone to the FM airwaves.
Playing a lot of indie rock. At a young age, you've already built up a very impressive business resume. So how did a BA in religious studies translate into becoming a highly successful alternative media culture entrepreneur?
I don't know. I kind of look back and I think it's almost, it's hard for me to connect with my going to school at all. It's almost like that was an accident. I think my studying in school it can be compared to the record label in a way where I came to school, I wanted to study business and journalism. That's what I was really excited about in high school. And when I wanted to study what I was going to do in life, and I thought I was going to be a writer and be an entrepreneur in some way. And when I started taking those classes at IU, I found that they just weren't really feeding me in the way I wanted to be fed by class. And I took a few religious studies classes, and those were what were really really driving me, and I found them fascinating. And I actually loved reading at night for those classes, and so I kind of just ditched the practical goals for school and kind of went with what I would actually enjoy. And that kind of coincided with when we were starting the record labels, and I was kind of, I felt like I was getting my practical schooling by actually doing it. You know, why take classes about business if you can just act, you know, in commerce, so.
And does running a record label ever feel to you sort of like your religious purpose in life?
If religiosity can, you know, is passion and you know, being driven towards something, maybe in a, you know, something is pushing you towards something, then probably. But I think more what was really drawing me to the religious studies classes and the professors that were teaching them was like the study of passions and like a search for ecstasy in everyday life, and that's what I was finding that in all the records I was listening to and just kind of the arts that I was drowning myself in at the time. And so
how did you end up coming to Indiana University from Fargo?
I knew I wanted to stay in the Midwest. I've always felt like a, you know, a real Midwest kind of guy, and I wanted to go to a public school. I wasn't really interested in a private school type environment, and IU was the most beautiful campuses of the schools I visited, and the schools I visited were kind of based on having a great journalism and business program, which IU obviously thrives in, and you know, it's kind of that's what got me here, and then I quickly kind of left that behind. So,
and you worked in a record store for a while.
Yeah.
I believe that's where I actually met you. How old were you when you started the label?
It was 1996. I guess we started talking about it in 95 when I was 20. I was in living at Collins Living Learning Center, the dorm here, and working with Jonathan Cargill, who was my immediate supervisor, and we'd sit and sort silverware and just talk about records. And no one likes to sort silverware, but we kind of went there because that's when we could go and just chat, you know. And we found a real common interest there.
Well, it's sort of a basic question, but how does one go about starting up a record label?
That's exactly what we were asking ourselves. We knew we wanted to be involved in music in some way other than just being kind of passive consumers. And I think that deep down inside, my partners, Jonathan and my brother Ben and Eric, who started the label with us at the time also, I don't think any of us really saw ourselves being players in the long term, like musicians. Jonathan and Ben are musicians, and so is Eric, but I think that we kind of knew that we could maybe contribute in a different way. And we're massive collectors of music, and that kind of we saw that we could find artists that maybe perhaps could be presented in a different way, and we could be involved some way that way, you know.
And that was 10 years ago. You're coming up on the 10th anniversary of Secretly Canadian. How did you arrive at the name Secretly Canadian for your record label? It's kind of an intriguing name.
Yeah, at the time we kind of wanted something that didn't really mean a whole lot, but that maybe had a little bit of, just sounded interesting. And I think in hindsight, you know, we're often like, God, what were we thinking? But, Ben and I growing up, you know, in Fargo, just south of the Canadian border, we've always kind of been fascinated by Canadian culture, and there's something just so quintessentially Canadian about certain people. And we were always trying to pinpoint what is that Canadian quality, and it's just kind of a and so we would always kind of refer to people as Secretly Canadian, and it just kind of got we ended up.
I think it's
sticking.
A good name because it almost has a slightly subversive connotation to it. It's a good name for an indie.
And Canadians love it. We sell a lot of records in Canada, so they're very flattered. So.
Some of our listeners might be curious to hear a definition of what you and I and other people would call indie rock or indie music. How would you define it if it can be defined?
Man, there's so many different ways to
25
do it.
Words or less.
Yeah.
But,
a lot of people consider now that it's kind of being used in a commercial sense, a lot of people kind of think indie rock is a sound. I've always kind of more taken it from the commerce aspect. Like indie rock is, it's a process, you know, it's like, has to do with doing it on your own, do it yourself mentality, DIY, kind of bands or friends of bands, taking and doing the same thing that major labels are doing every day and kind of learning on their own how to do it and doing it outside, kind of off the grid, so to speak. And, although the grid is, you know, what the grid is something that, you know, now that major labels and indie labels are, the difference between the two is blurring every day now, because indie labels are selling a lot of records these days, and a lot of the major labels are looking at what the indie labels are doing and they're wanting to replicate that because they don't have as many huge blockbusters as they once did, or they do have blockbusters, but they're not selling as much as they once were. They don't have records that are selling 10 million copies anymore. And they're looking at indie labels that are having success of selling a couple hundred thousand at a time, and they're wanting to co-opt that in some way. And so I guess the difference between indie and major is it's not as great anymore. But I guess I still refer to things as feeling indie, and I guess it's just kind of have when it kind of has a grassroots boutique quality to it. It doesn't necessarily appeal to a mass audience, although that audience is getting larger. So.
Well, Secretly Canadian seems like it was very much a do-it-yourself operation. I mean, you started it up with, you said, three other people,
mm-hmm.
but it's grown quite a lot, hasn't it, over the past few years?
It has, yes. We've been expanding. We used to, I think we started off and we worked with a lot of different companies throughout the record-making process, people to help us record the music, master the music, do the design, manufacture, promote, market, and distribute, and, you know, all the way down the line. And I guess we really value having a really deep relationship with our artists, and we're also very kind of ambitious and we have high expectations of every step of the process. And we started to realize that maybe we wanted to control more parts of that process, not necessarily depend on subcontracting all those different processes out. And so we started to bring more of it in-house. And as a result, our staff has grown. And our record labels have grown as well. But I think a lot of our growth stems from just we're doing more more of the whole entire spectrum. Not all 360 degrees, but
You brought more of the operations of running a small but growing and very successful record company kind of in-house, and you're doing these things yourself. How did you get into music? What did you listen to as a kid? What really kind of sparked your interest in rock music?
I think it was Huey Lewis and the News. I think when I was a kid, you know, just the radio, just like any other kid. Some kids are drawn towards sports and comics. I was drawn toward a lot of different things. I had a lot of different collections, but somehow music was the one thing that really stuck, that endured for me. You know, whether it was morning or night, or whether I was a pre-teenager, a teenager, or beyond, it just it really stuck. And I don't know, it wasn't until I was maybe in high school and going to see rock and roll bands that didn't have records out that I started to think, oh, I might do this someday. I think when I was a kid, I always dreamed of being on stage, being the singer, being the rock star, you know, like most kids do. But
it seems like there are so many local music scenes. If you go around the country, where there are wonderful music acts, rock acts, pop rock acts that never end up going anywhere, not because they weren't talented or they didn't have the songs, but because they never were able to find a record label home that was able to either one, promote them effectively enough, or to distribute them effectively enough, or bands that would sign with a label and record a really great album, and then a week later the label goes belly up, which is just devastating for a band.
I don't think that every band is in it to do a business. I think sometimes it's just that there's that joy, and I've never done it. I've never performed on stage, but the one thing I think I've gleaned from being around musicians so much is that they, aside from any sort of potential fame that they may be seeking, or you know, money or any of that, there is that intrinsic value in just the performance aspect, the collaboration and the creative process that drives a lot of musicians who might deep down inside know this is never really going to go anywhere, and that's okay. I might only play to 20 people every few months for the rest of my life. Or bands that maybe have that initial ambition, they want to make it, then they have that kind of epiphany along the line. Maybe they're, you know, they hit a certain age and they realize, this is just going to be a hobby for me. This isn't going to be a career. But they keep going at it. And that's just kind of, there's that kind of intoxicating experience that musicians have. And I think that's the same thing with people who run record labels. Unless it gets to a point where you just simply can't afford to do it anymore, which a lot of people find ways around that. Like, we have a lot of friends who have kind of accepted the fact that the record label that they started is not going to be a career. They found their job working somewhere else at a more stable environment. They have kids and everything, but they're still doing that label because it's just, that's how they exercise their passion with music. And I think it's the same with musicians. And I think different record labels look for different things, and we're the sort of record label now that we're being drawn toward. I buy lots of records for people who are doing it just because they love it, but we're kind of being drawn now more towards musicians who kind of want to make a career of it, because we're making a career of the record label aspect, and that's what drives. I think a lot of the musicians out there, who the Coldplays of the world, they are inspired both by the commercial successes, but, you know, they have those records, those hidden gems that they find that drive them and inspire them to make music.
So you have this great passion for music, and it's your business now. It's what you do for a living in one way or another. So how many hours a day do you listen to music now?
I have music on probably 12 to 14 hours a day, but I'm actually probably listening for, you know, my ear is tuned to the waves probably 6 to 8 hours, you know, where I can actually hear it, you know. But it's an ambient force in my life. It's dead air is awkward for me, and so, although I probably need more of it in my life, but yeah, it's on all the time.
So 12 to 14 hours a day that you listen to it. Do you ever feel like you hit a saturation point where it's just...
No, I think I more worry that my body is saturated and I'm not recognizing it, you know. I think it's like, it's maybe not healthy to have to be bombarded by. If music isn't playing, rest assured that I'm either asleep or there's a movie on. It's like one of those things. So
How do you see young listening audiences, which I kind of get the sense that's generally what you're targeting, probably not only what you're targeting at Secret Only Canadian, but a lot of your releases seem to be targeted at a college-age audience or a little bit older, a little bit younger. How do you see young listening audiences of today as compared to previous generations?
I think, you know, that it's how they experience music is different. You know, there's, you know, I think computers are changing the way people listen to music, and you know, there are trends and cycles that go, like, there are I think we're entering into a singles age again, where people just, you know, the attention span is quick. You don't want to hear a whole album. The iPod and computers and satellite radio and all this and MTV, they're all kind of coalescing. It's coalescing in a way where people want to hear just the best song by an artist at any given moment, and then they move on to the next artist, and it's kind of more of a jukebox type listening experience now for a lot of people. I think some people are still drawn to the album as a work of art, as a novel, you know. But other than, I think that kids are still just drawn to that passion, that primal essence that they hear in rock and roll or in hip hop or in jazz or whatever. They're still drawn to the same quality. They just kind of experience it on a different platform. So
you talked about music going through cycles, and I think indie rock or college rock or whatever you want to call it, which has been around now for at least a couple of decades, has gone through some cycles and phases itself. What do you think the general state of it is today? Do you think we're in a good period or a fairly?
I think it's a fantastic period, and if only because I am purchasing more of a kind of a plurality of type of music right now. I'm buying a lot of independent music, and it's not just because I'm buying a lot of music, I don't think. I think like last year in the last few years, like if I were to make a top 10 of my favorite music, it's probably pretty well represented both independent and major label. Whereas 10 years ago, I would say that a vast majority of the records, my favorite records each year, were released by independent record labels. And so that major labels are releasing what I find are really important and fun and exciting music right now alongside the indies, perhaps because they're trying to replicate something that some success that the indies are having. That is exciting. I think people have more access to good music right now. And because of the media things we've been talking about, like I guess downloading and satellite radio, it's easier for people to find exactly what they like and to go down a very personalized niche if they choose to do so. So I think, anyone who says that that music is not what it was in the 60s, you know, I think that they're leaning too much on the crutch of history and hindsight and they're editing out all the garbage that was there then too.
Well, you've brought along some music for us, and one of the things we're going to hear is a contemporary indie rock act that you've signed to the Secretly Canadian label, Anthony and the Johnsons. Can you talk a little bit about this track that we're going to hear now?
It's the song "Hope There's Someone," which is probably the song that's connected with the most people on that album. It largely led to him winning the Mercury Prize in the UK, which is probably the closest equivalent in the UK to a Grammy. He beat out just about every important, he beat out Coldplay and a lot of other huge acts for that, and it was a huge upset. This guy from New York who was on some small independent label, and it was massive. And a little bit of that has crept over into the States, but he's still kind of a very much an underground sensation, and he's someone that we're really excited to be working with. I bought his record maybe in 2001 based on a review I read online. I mail ordered the record. It was put out on a very small UK label and fell in love with it. And he kind of grew up honed his musical persona in New York in the kind of gay cabaret scene there. And he's developed quite a bit. He's kind of compared to Nina Simone a great deal. So
this is Anthony and the Johnsons from their album "I Am a Bird Now," doing "Hope There's Someone" on Profiles.
Hope there's someone who'll take care of me when I die. Will I go? Hope there's someone who'll set my heart free, nice to hold when I'm tired. There's a ghost on the horizon. When I go to bed, how can I fall asleep at night? How will I raise my head? Oh, I'm scared of the middle place.
That was Antony and the Johnsons performing Hope There's Someone from their secretly Canadian release, I Am a Bird Now. Chris, we talked about this a little bit earlier, and you said that you feel like major labels and independent labels like secretly Canadian are becoming more alike. But in what ways do they remain different? How is secretly Canadian different from, say, a label that's owned or distributed by Sony or Universal or one of the few remaining large conglomerates that's out there?
I think there's I'll talk about two different ways, one of which is purely commerce. And that's we have some artists that are getting to the stage where they're being courted by major labels. And, you know, they ask me, you know, what or any of my partners, what should I do? And, you know, I think the big difference between major labels and indie labels on a commercial potential level is that they are solely equipped to make a hit single. Independent labels still, that's it's out of their grasp, even though they have access to so much and pretty much own the internet for all intents and purposes in terms of coverage. Major labels own the airwaves in terms of their access to the most important stations out there. And so there aren't really, there's maybe one or two examples a year of an independent act having a hit single. And so that's one. And so we always tell a band, if you think that you have a hit single in you, and you think if we can get a good contract at a major label, it might be worth considering. But to date, it hasn't happened. You know, that hit single is highly elusive. And then the second thing is more, I think, kind of on a relationship level. Major labels have really talented, very highly experienced people working for them, and you can do a lot of great things. But I think the one thing about being, say, on a label like Secretly Canadian is it's owner operated. You are working with alongside the owners of the company. And one thing we tell the acts that we work with is if you work with Secretly Canadian, you will always be working with Jonathan, Ben, Darius, and myself. And that's a really important thing. You'll never have buffers between you.
But what, and this kind of leads into what I wanted to ask, what happens to a small label if they do suddenly have, say, a Nirvana Nevermind type success, which I know that actually happened on a major label, but let's say Nirvana hadn't left Sub Pop. Mm-hmm. They had stayed on Sub Pop or they were on a secretly Canadian type label, and suddenly you've got a record that's selling 500,000 copies a week and secretly Canadians being overwhelmed with, could you guys handle a success like that if you were to have a success like that?
I think if it got to the point where there was a single, we would probably need support from a major label. We do have major label distribution. We're distributed by the same company that distributes, by WEA, the Warner Elektra Atlantic Group, Warner's Group. And so that's where we would ask them for an enormous amount of help. And it happens a lot. A lot of hip-hop acts start out on an independent label, and when the record starts to take off, they sell 200,000, 300,000 in a very short amount of time. They then get major label support, and they have a next phase of the record. Franz Ferdinand is a good example. They started on an independent label, Domino. The record took off very quickly. Ended up selling, I think, a couple million copies, and it ended up getting picked up. Domino ended up forming a partnership for that record or for that act with a major label. So it's called upstreaming, and it's something that happens.
So no matter how successful Secretly Canadian became and no matter how many titles you were putting out or whatever, you can't foresee a day when you would become so big that kind of owner-artist relationship that you were just talking about would have to be sort of pushed back somewhat.
I think it would be really hard for us to not have – I mean, for us, the most valuable part of the process and the thing that makes the process – different from just being a fan is the relationship with the artist, that direct relationship with the artist in the creative process. And I think if we remove from that, I hope that my if that ever happened, that I'd have a lot of alarms flashing in my head, because really the most valuable thing is the relationships. And if they become barriers or distortion fields between that important relationship, then we're in trouble. And then that's probably wouldn't be the same type of company.
You know, it's interesting because it seems as if there are several stereotypes about music industry business people, that they're greedy or they're decadent or they're disconnected from the artists they represent. They often seem rather vilified, particularly mm-hmm. when you hear recording artists talk about them. And you seem to be very much geared in being the opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a stereotype. I mean, but bands are also, you know, portrayed as being indulgent and
Spinal
you know,
Tap.
They have, yeah, exactly. And so I think that's just a more fun story to tell. But really, I think a lot of my favorite labels are run by very humble people that are also very ambitious. And sometimes you do get people are pretty complex, you know, and you get the good days and you get the bad days, you know.
The Al Pacino Scarface.
Yeah. You know, hopefully there's more good days than bad days, you know, or good experiences than bad experiences.
Right.
And so.
Right. Well, can you describe a day in the life of a record company head? I mean, what does your day generally consist of when you go in the offices of Secretly Canadian?
Lots of email and lots of meetings. It's like, as our staff has grown, it has involved, a big part of the process has been more meetings and more, you know, trying to bring a team together and try to figure out where are we at and everything. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of time on the phone talking to bands, you know, and that's like, I try every day to get closer and closer to being able to spend as much time with the bands and with people as can be. You know, early on, I spent a lot of time, you know, in doing accounting I was doing the bookkeeping work. That was the hat that I wore of our partnership, you know, and God, I'm tired of doing that sort of thing. I want to work with people, you know. I want to work with bands, and I want to work with coworkers that love working with bands. So,
what's your take as a record label owner on the various copyright battles that have gone on in recent years over Napster and MP3s and downloads and all of these other new technologies that have affected the music and media industry so much?
I mean, it's interesting. It's definitely keeping everyone on their toes, trying to figure out how to interact with this just new paradigm almost. And I think that independent labels have less reason to feel threatened right now, simply because we have always and will always, independent labels will always cater to a less broad of an audience. And the people who want to buy our records right now still really cherish the artwork. They want to have a physical, tactile experience with the record. It's not just purely an audio experience. You know, there are people who we sell records to still get lost in the mythology of musicians, you know, making up this whole, like, story in their head of what this band is about and what they stand for and what they look like and what they're like as people. And so the purely, like, just free downloads and pirated downloads is less of a threat for us, I think. It's more of a promotional tool. That said, it is exciting to see downloading become more, I guess, legitimized, and I guess the music industry is learning how to fit it into a box, you know. And I think it's really exciting. And I don't know if you've read The Long Tail by Chris Anderson, that piece, but you know, I think that as a result of all the downloading, people do, that's part of this whole thing of people having more access to the sort of music that they like. And you don't have to be bombarded by Britney Spears if you're not interested in Britney Spears.
Right.
So. Right.
So is it easier in the age of the internet to promote bands that are just starting out? It just seems like word of mouth is such a different concept now than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
Jag Jaguar, Secretly Canadian's sister label that we run. We run these two labels side by side. Most people know Secretly Canadian more because it's Bloomington. It started in Bloomington. Jag Jaguar moved to Bloomington and became partners with us. But Jag Jaguar's like slogan is word of mouth. We depend on it, and it's true. I mean, that's like when I talk about mythology building, and you know, that's word of mouth is what creates that, and it's not what just feeding press releases to fans and they go out and buy it, and you know, it's people creating their own interpretation of what the band is and what it, and so I mean we depend on it. That's the difference between interesting and you know, and exciting.
It just seems like, you know, you can get today. I could listen to this Anthony and the Johnsons song that we just heard, or something else that your label's put out. I could get on a discussion board this evening of independent rock and say, "Hey, I just heard this record and I love it." And within 24 hours, maybe thousands of people all over the world might have been able to read that. And
that's exciting.
That's something that you couldn't have done 15 or 20 years ago.
And it is. It's bringing different kind of bands to the surface right now. And not necessarily different sounds, but bands that have only been bands for a couple minutes are like, if they had a great recording experience and made this great sounding tune, maybe they've never even played out live, but and it gets on the internet and someone hears it and they pass it on. It just, it can breed like wildfire. It's pretty crazy. It's exciting. That I think bands have more access to the sort of, I guess, to media that major labels used to just own that, and now the need for record labels need to work harder now in order to justify being involved with bands, because bands can do a lot of it on their own.
For your record label, for Secretly Canadian, was there a moment or a CD release when you really sensed that the label was going to become the success that it is today?
I don't know. I think early on, it was our second release by Songs Ohio that got distributors from the UK and Holland and Germany to call us up. And we're like, we didn't, you know, that was something that we hadn't thought that far ahead, that we might want to sell records outside of the United States. I mean, I think it was something that we intuitively wanted, but we hadn't yet articulated a goal for it. And so I think that our goals are kind of, we reevaluate them every day, and they keep getting set, and we kind of reach a new level. And it's like, wow, this is exciting. And I think it was with Songs Ohio that we really felt like this was an exciting thing. And if we can maintain our relationship with Jason Molina from Songs Ohio and other artists like him, if we can learn to have our business model be scalable, where we can grow along with the artist, that we're gonna do well. And as long as we stay really committed both to the artists, their music, and doing business in a really conscientious way, I think that we knew that things were gonna work out.
Well, the music we're going to hear next was a debut single of the group Songs Ohio, and was this the song that kind of like captivated your interest in them?
Yeah, I bought the 7-inch down at TD CDs and LPs when it was still in the alley, in that little hut there.
Here in Bloomington.
Yeah, here in Bloomington, and probably played it 100 times, sat in my dorm room sophomore year and just played it over and over and over again. And then when we... You know, he was one of the first artists that were like, we have to work with this guy. But, you know, he's clearly too good for us. He's, you know, out of our grasp. And got in touch with him through some mutual friends and everything. And he agreed to do a single with us and then a full length. And now we've done like 9 records with him. And he's Songs Ohio and Jason Molina. Now he plays under the name Magnolia Electric Company with some guys here in Bloomington. And he's really been I would say a lot of our staying power is a result of our relationship with Jason and him working so hard and everything. It's an honor to work with him.
This is Songs Ohio, their debut single on Palace Records, Soul on Profiles.
Tell all your friends that you're bound for glory, and how long do you know that you make it there before me? What is it like Is it worth this misfortune?
That was Songs Ohio performing the song Soul from their debut single on Palace Records. We're talking with Chris Swanson, the owner of the Secretly Canadian record label, on Profiles this evening. Chris, how do you go about deciding to sign an act? How do you and your partners actually go through that process?
Well, it starts off as just being a fan of the music. You hear it, and it's like, wow. You know, you have to... I think we all try to tune out that radar that we have, that this could sell a lot of records. I mean, we list that radar does go off, but it's more like we try to find the more... I think the more pure signals in our heads and in our bodies that says this is good music. You know, you get that giddy, exciting feel like you did when you first heard, you know, Guns N' Roses for the first time when you were a kid. And if you're getting that feeling, those alarms are going off. Then you go to the next step. Can I work and have a, you know, can we build a relationship with these guys and maybe have and do. Work together for a long time. We're not really interested in short-term relationships with bands. We don't sign multi-album contracts. We don't lock bands in. But one thing we're really open with all our bands before we work with them about is we don't want to be a stepping stone. We want to find someone that we can become partners with. And sometimes there are bands it's just okay to be a fan of. And you have to just tell yourself, it's okay. I can just buy the record and listen to it, you know, and enjoy it. That's okay. And so... We try to find people that we not only are really passionate about, but that we want to spend time with, want to hang out with, and work with for a long time.
Do you vote on whether or not to sign an act? Does everybody have to agree on it?
We've never signed an artist that we weren't all passionate about. And that's a pretty big test right there. I mean, with Secretly Canadian, there's three of us. With Jag Jaguar, there's two of us. And we don't sign an act that we all can't sign off on. That's really important to us.
Have you ever turned down any acts that went on to become really successful?
Oh yeah, yep. The Arcade Fire—that's a kicker. Yeah, they're doing okay for themselves, and that was a great recording they sent us too, and we just didn't act fast enough. And Devendra Banhart, and I mean, there's a long list of really exciting artists. They're just like, oh, keep you up at night a little bit. keep you playing the stereo for 12 hours a day. So the one exciting thing is that there is like a community of labels out there that we're all kind of, you know, in it for the same thing. And you know, both those acts sign to labels that are really great and that, you know, deserve to thrive with those acts. So.
Will you continue to carry an act that doesn't either sell as well as you'd hope maybe, or that maybe is in some way or another not fulfilling certain commercial hopes that you'd had, whatever the level of commercial hopes are that you need to entertain as an independent record company?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, as long as the music is still inspiring those passions in us, that's all that matters. And it's interesting because a lot of the successful bands that we've signed really kind of, one of the things, like when they came to us and they sent us their music or we met them, it's interesting what bands that they're drawn to on our label. Oftentimes, it's some of the less commercially successful bands, you know, those, you know, musicians, you know. And so I think as long as we put out records by bands who continue to push themselves creatively and just make great records, that's really at the end of the day. And plus, history changes how we look at records. A record that doesn't sell very well now, you know, in 30 years, maybe it might still not be selling well, but it might be just critically, people might notice it all of a sudden. Nick Drake is a great example of an artist who, you know, no one cared about when he was around Velvet Underground. Great example, you know. So history has a way of you know.
Well, exactly. Those records are serving their current label owners quite well.
Yeah,
in
commercially.
Terms of catalog sales.
And also, even if they weren't selling, like, I'm trying to think of a good example. Like, you know, Incredible String Band is a good example of a band that's never really sold a lot of records. I'm sure no one's lost money on them, but they're a band that continues to find passionate new fans every year. And so That's exciting.
Well, you brought along some other music by a band that might kind of fit into what we were just sort of talking about, and that would be Marmoset. Do you want to talk a little bit about this track that we're going to hear next?
Yeah, it's from my very favorite record that we've released on Secretly Canadian called Record in Red. And, you know, this is probably one of the most criminally overlooked artists and records that we've been a part of. And this is the record. It was our 35th release, and we're up at we're at 150 now on Secretly Canadian, and this is one I just keep coming back to. And it's not just me, it's our entire staff, whether they were there when it came out or just totally new, you know, when we, like, interns hear it and they're like, man, what is this? How come I haven't heard this, you know? And they're just a band that it's not a science, it's an art. We haven't learned how to find this band a lot of fans yet, so...
This is Marmoset from their album Record in Red on the Secretly Canadian label, performing Torn Cup, Fly Up Above on Profiles.
Fly up above, some make a lie and a tie track of love. Would you hit me, please, by the river to see? No way for the time we come.
The band Marmoset performing Torn Cup, Fly Up Above from the Secretly Canadian release Record in Red. We're talking with one of the partners that runs Secretly Canadian, Chris Swanson. And Chris, in addition to music, you also have a passion for movies that has ended up being channeled into a business. How did that come about?
I was working at Plan 9 Video for a few years, back when it was still on the corner of, Walnut and Kirkwood, down in the dungeon, as we like to refer to it. And that was exciting. And then working with Kerry Scott, the founder of Plan 9, and when he had the brain aneurysm a few years ago and wasn't able to run the shop anymore. So a good friend and Plan 9 customer, Dave Walter, he and I, we took the shop over and have been having a lot of fun with that. It's awesome.
What are some of your favorite movies and movie genres?
I tend more toward the slow and depressing, you know, emotionally convoluted movies. You know, I like John Cassavetes and Werner Herzog, and you know, movies that are you can't just pop on any time. You know, dreadful movies, just like, oh, you know, devastating movies. But I'm a big fan of 70s Hollywood films. So I think my favorite film of all time is Woman Under the Influence, or maybe Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So, you know, the emotionally complex movies.
Well, you have a company here in Bloomington. You have this movie store here in Bloomington now. You live here. You own some property here. What is it about the city that has kept you here?
I don't know. It's an exciting... I think, first of all, it's my speed. I love a small college town. I love... You know, what first drew me here were the trees. You know, it was like I visited the campuses of Michigan and Ohio State. And, you know, those places were concrete palaces compared with the lush, you know, IU campus. And then, you know, when I moved here, you know, I was consumed with, I had the school goggles on, you know. But then when I slowly started to get, you know, reach out into downtown and whatnot. And I just love that Bloomington has a center, you know, that the downtown is not just it's a place where people live. They live near it. They play and they work all in this central place. Where I came from in Fargo is just sprawled out. You know, you spend an enormous amount of time. It's not a huge city, but you spend a lot of your time in transit. You know, in Bloomington, it's like people, there's a center to it. It's got personality. The local commerce is fantastic. I mean, it's not part of this homogenized America that you know, you see everywhere else in, say, in Indiana, you know, and it's and then the people, you know, the people are great.
Well, what would your advice be to somebody, and not just somebody young in their 20s or early 30s, but somebody of any age who wants to start a business similar to yours?
I guess, you know, you have to find out what you're, if you're passionate about something and you're focused and you're organized, or if you're not organized, surround yourself with someone who is organized. And I think you're going to succeed, unless it's a highly competitive industry. You know, like I wouldn't start an Indian restaurant in Bloomington. That'd be tough. You know, there's a couple of great Indian restaurants. I wouldn't want to compete there, even though I am passionate about Indian food. But like, I think if you have to be passionate about it. You know, passion is what drive. And I think customers, you go into a store or a restaurant or whatever, if you can tell right away, whether you're able to articulate that or not, it's just a feeling. You know, if the owners, operators of that establishment are passionate about what they do, you know, and without that, it's just business. And I think that at least that's what I love about Bloomington. People, you know, like Bloomington residents, they want to go somewhere where there's that personality and passion in there. They're not interested in going to McDonald's, you know. I mean, it happens every once in a while. McDonald's happens. It's a bummer. But you know, it was when McDonald's closed in downtown Bloomington, I thought that was, you know, really interesting. And, you know, people want to go to, they want to have some semblance of local flavor, you know. So, and it's the passion and that provides that personality, I think.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And this is David Brent Johnson. You've been listening to record label owner and cultural entrepreneur Chris Swanson on Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in June of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.